afternoon and welcome to this news event sponsored by the Institute for Energy and Environmental Research, IEER. IEER will be releasing is releasing today a report on nuclear waste reprocessing, breeder reactors. That report is available to you now on the website for the Institute for Energy and Environmental Research. It's in the upper right-hand corner of the website. You can find a link to the report and related news release. That's at IEER.org. Again, www.IEER.org. You'll be hearing today from two experts, one of whom will be offering an opening statement. Before we introduce those two experts to you, I'd like to invite the operator back on the line to explain how the Q&A period will work.
During the question and answer session, you may ask a question by pressing star, then one on your touch-tone phone. If you would like to remove yourself from the question queue, you may press star, then two. Again, it's star, then one to ask a question.
And we will have the operator back on the line at the conclusion of the Q&A period, at the conclusion of the opening statements, rather, so that you can hear once again how it is that you can pose your questions. We do want to emphasize that the Q&A period will be reserved for members of the news media, and we'll be taking your questions again after the opening statement of the first speaker. As I mentioned, you'll be hearing from two experts today. The first expert that you'll be hearing from offering an opening statement will be Institute for Energy and Environmental Research President Dr. Arjun Makhijani. Dr. Arjun Makhijani will be making a statement, and he will be joined during the Q&A period by a second expert, Frank von Hippel, who is co-chair of the International Panel on Fissile Materials and professor of Public and International Affairs at the Woodrow Wilson School at Princeton University. So at this time, what we'll do is we'll hear the opening statement of IEER President Dr. Arjun Makhijani.
Thank you, Scott. I'm Arjun Makhijani. I'm president of the Institute for Energy and Environmental Research and the author of the report, The Mythology and Messy Reality of Nuclear Fuel Reprocessing. In recent years, a French fever has gripped the promoters of nuclear power in the United States. Praise of its management of spent fuel by reprocessing. Now, reprocessing takes the used fuel from nuclear reactors, which contains mostly leftover uranium, highly radioactive fission products, and about 1% plutonium, and separates those three things. And the French have carried out reprocessing of their spent fuel for some time, most of their spent fuel, and the United States has not. And currently, since the United States is in something of a bind about nuclear waste because of the cancellation of Yucca Mountain, the rightful cancellation of Yucca Mountain, which is a poor repository project, there's been a lot of discussion about France. And France is kind of romantically held up not for April in Paris, but for its nuclear technology. Bill Magwood, who was appointed commissioner of the Nuclear Regulatory Commission by President Obama, actually wrote him a memorandum 5 days before his inauguration with Mark Ribbing of the Progressive Policy Institute, and he said the following: while looking to France for inspiration may not play well with domestic audiences, it is one of the first places to look for ideas on how to handle nuclear waste. Actually, the French do not think of it as nuclear waste. After a three-year cooling down period, 96 or 97% of that material is potentially reusable uranium and plutonium and so on. Now, this has become the mantra. Professor Miller has written an op-ed in the papers along the same lines. We should look to France. It is really a mantra of nuclear waste management. It is not a result of a serious analysis. Using most of the uranium in spent fuel requires a special type of reactor called a breeder reactor. Breeder reactors are not commercial. We've spent worldwide about $100 billion trying to make them commercial, and they still have safety, proliferation, and cost issues associated with them. There's been essentially no learning curve associated with such reactors because the most recent demonstration reactors, Superphénix in France, the largest one ever built, operated at less than 8% capacity factor over its lifetime before it was permanently closed, And Manju, and the most recent one built worldwide, went critical in 1994 and had a sodium fire in 1995, and it remains closed, although it is, the Japanese hope to reopen it. The approach invites serious, you know, in the physics of it looks attractive and has long looked attractive, but the approach invites serious cost, safety, and proliferation problems. Spent fuel in the United States, if it's converted to fissile materials, contains on the order of 10 million nuclear bombs worth of fissile materials. To convert it all into fuel and use it will take hundreds of years and involve the separation of tens of thousands of bombs worth of material every year for hundreds of years. If it costs a penny more to generate electricity this way than the way we do it, ways we do it, we would otherwise do it, it would cost $8 trillion extra for every penny in extra cost per kilowatt hours, which is more than the value of all the electricity produced during the creation of that spent fuel, a lot more. This is mythology on the scale of too cheap to meter romance of the 1950s about nuclear power. It's neither sensible to think about it, nor should the Blue Ribbon Commission be entertaining ideas about reprocessing as a serious solution to the spent fuel problem of the United States. The French pay more for reprocessing. They create more waste. Actually, reprocessing creates greater than Class C waste, which has to be disposed of in a repository, and high-level waste glass. Now, the glass has a slightly smaller volume, but there's so much more waste contaminated with plutonium and so on that the total repository volume would increase by about six times compared to the U.S. policy currently. The French spend about 2 cents per kilowatt hour more for electricity. The storage of liquid wastes, high-level waste, carries some risks. The Norwegian Radiation Protection Authority has estimated that in case of a severe accident in Britain, which also reprocesses, Norway could have contamination between 10 and 5,000% of the Norwegian contamination from the infamous Chernobyl accident. All that, and France still needs a geologic repository, and the French public doesn't like it, and opposition there has been comparable to the U.S. France not only doesn't use 90% of the uranium resource, France uses less than 1% of the underlying natural uranium resource. And with light water reactors such as the one they have and what we have, you cannot use more than 1% of the underlying uranium resource. So our recommendations and the proliferation risks have been adjudged to be serious not only by non-government parties and universities and academic research and so on. A recent paper published by Brookhaven National Lab and authored by scientists from labs around the country, including Los Alamos and Sandia, concluded that even with advanced reprocessing, which is now being promoted and the Blue Ribbon Commission is considering, the reduction of proliferation risks would not be significant. So I would suggest that we get rid of this French fever that is going to solve the waste problems. It's not going to solve the waste problems. It's going to increase risks. It's going to increase costs, and it's going to increase waste. And we should look to direct geologic disposal of spent fuel, safe interim storage, and create a path for doing those things. I also suggest that the Commission should send its own inquiry to the governments of Britain and France and ask for the data. How much fissile material, how much of the underlying uranium resource are they actually fissioning for energy? Do they have risks from high-level liquid waste storage that could result in catastrophic releases? I think it would put the public debate in the United States on a scientific footing. So far, we've had a continuation of the romance with the atom from the 1950s and little serious analysis and fact. And I did this report in order to put some analysis and facts about reprocessing on the table. Thank you.
That's the opening statement of our first speaker, and in fact our only speaker for this news event other than the expert joining during the Q&A period. You just heard the opening statement of Institute for Energy and Environmental Research President Dr. Arjun Makhijani. The report that Dr. Makhijani is referring to is available to you now on the website for the Institute for Energy and Environmental Research. That's at IEER.org. Again, www.IEER.org. It's accessible from the upper right-hand corner of the homepage. At this time, we're going to proceed to the question and answer period, and we'll be joined, as I mentioned before, by a second expert during the question and answer period, and I'll be identifying him again when we get through the instructions, which we'll receive again now from the operator. Operator, could you rejoin us to explain how members of the media can pose their questions?
At this time, if you would like to ask a question, please press star, then 1 on your touch-tone phone. If you decide to withdraw your question, please press star, then 2 to remove yourself from the list. Please limit yourself to one question and a single follow-up. If you need to ask an additional question, please know that you may press star, then 1 to rejoin the queue.
And as I mentioned before, we will be joined during the question and answer period by a second expert. His name is Frank von Hippel. He is co-chair of the International Panel on Fissile Materials. He's also professor of public and international affairs at the Woodrow Wilson School at Princeton University. He'll be joining Dr. Arjun Makhijani from the organization sponsoring today's news conference, which is the Institute for Energy and Environmental Research. Operator, do we have our first question at this time?
Yes, our first question comes from Matt Wald of the New York Times. Please go ahead.
Hi, Arjun and Frank. I attended a Platts session in February where Jacques Besagneau, president of Areva Inc., or the U.S. subsidiary of Areva, spoke on this subject, and he raised a slightly different idea, which is, recycling plutonium is not a substitute for it forms a variety of functions. It's a substitute for mining and milling new uranium, in addition to being a substitute for enrichment and a substitute for burying a potential energy resource irretrievably. I wonder if your calculations would come out differently if I said, yeah, we want to recycle this stuff because it will reduce the demonstrated environmental harm that comes from mining, milling, and enrichment.
Really, you can't reduce that environmental harm with a light water reactor system significantly. If you look at the Areva's system, what they have, reprocessing with light water reactors, it generates less than 10. They reprocess almost most of their spent fuel. They load only 20 of their 58 reactors with 30% MOX score, and so this supplies less than 10% of their electricity. All of their uranium is imported, and that's more than 90% of their fuel. If you want to really get rid of uranium mining, you have to go to breeder reactors, which have all the kinds of problems I've talked about. $100 billion, proliferation risks. You cannot make use of the uranium resource in the way suggested without a breeder reactor reprocessing system. And that carries all of the headaches that I have described. Besides, breeder reactors are not reliable. They have safety issues and they're not commercial. So, for the French to suggest that they are really recycling and reducing environmental impacts is a little ridiculous. They've polluted the oceans all the way to the Arctic with their discharges into the English Channel. They've had 11 of the Western European countries ask them to stop reprocessing. Even some of their reprocessing customers have asked them to stop reprocessing, like Germany and Belgium. So I think there's a lot of propaganda and promotionalism going on around reprocessing as it is happening in France with very little reference to the facts.
Frank?
I guess I'd add that it's actually all of the reprocessing customers of France and the UK and Russia have not renewed their contracts except for the Netherlands, which has one half a gigawatt old reactor, which has renewed its reprocessing contract. It's because it's so costly. I think a lot of the U.S. debate, in fact, is driven by Areva, has been pushing very hard. I've been inviting lots of congressmen to come and for briefings to Normandy, and would like to build a. I mean, they would be the obvious, if the U.S. did build a reprocessing plant, Areva would be the obvious company to do it, and it would be a huge, you know, it would be $40 billion there. Right now they're having economic troubles, and it would be a big boost for them. I'd like to also add that the other political appeal of reprocessing is the fact it gives you some place to ship spent fuel to off-site. And that's what has led Japan to reprocess, because Japan, the local governments in Japan apparently are not allowing the Japanese nuclear utilities to do what we do in the U.S., which is when the spent fuel pools are full, we take the older spent fuel out and put it into dry casks, and therefore. Japan first shipped spent fuel to UK and France, but then when those contracts had the high level waste from the spent fuel coming back, and it was no more easy to deal with the politics of finding a place to store the high level waste than it was for the original spent fuel, and so they ultimately decided to build a reprocessing plant where they could ship both the high-level waste coming back from Europe and also the spent fuel being discharged from their reactors. But the costs are enormous, in their cost-benefit analysis, they concluded that the only thing more expensive than reprocessing would be to shut down all their reactors, which they felt they would have to do if they didn't have any place to ship the spent fuel to.
I was at a conference sponsored by Hazel O'Leary in the 90s when she was energy secretary, and we're not allowed to say who said what, but we were allowed to say what was said. And one of the utility executives said, "I want you to take the spent fuel away, and I don't care where you put it." And I think that's the sentiment that Areva and others are tapping into, because it solves the problem for the utilities. And, of course, you know, in fairness, the ratepayers have been paying the government to take away the spent fuel. But it really creates bigger problems for ratepayers and taxpayers and for waste and proliferation. Even though you might have a place to ship it off the utility sites.
Is there a follow-up question there?
No, thank you.
Okay. And we'll explain in a moment how it is that people can rejoin the queue if they'd like to after they've posed their initial question. But at this time, operator, let's proceed to our second question.
The next question comes from David Biello of the Scientific American. Please go ahead.
Hi, thanks for taking my question. It's kind of a follow-up to Matt Wald's. You know, the justification, the flip side justification that gets put out there is that eventually we're going to run out of uranium. The uranium that we're finding now is low grade and or coming from folks that we don't necessarily want to be buying uranium from, like Kazakhstan, Areva, you know, the company that's, I guess, behind the reprocessing fever. Itself got out of mining in the U.S., although that seems to be more of a political thing than a resource thing. What about the whole running out of uranium argument?
Okay, let's not confuse problems. The biggest problem for spent fuel and waste management is the spent fuel that is coming out of the existing reactors. There's going to be about over 100,000 metric tons of that before we're done. As my report demonstrates, it's not sensible at all to try to think of using that uranium and converting the uranium-238 into plutonium and in breeder reactors and reprocessing and so on. Now, if you want a future nuclear system, then the question of, you know, how much more uranium you have to mine. Our assessment here is that the uranium resources in the world are plentiful. Besides, I think we can run the United States energy economy entirely on renewable resources and efficiency, and I did a book to that effect. We don't need to go to reprocessing and breeder reactors. Besides, they are not commercial. And so the price, reprocessing doesn't become economical until the price of uranium goes into the hundreds of dollars a pound. And at even $100 a pound, the underlying uranium resource would greatly increase. I mean, prices have been in the range of $8, $10, $20, $30, $40, $50 a pound of yellow cake over time. They've had slight peaks, but I think this whole idea of the underlying uranium resource and a future nuclear renaissance that's going to gobble it up is really promoting reprocessing in a way that doesn't make economic, it still doesn't make economic sense. Frank?
Yeah, I guess I would add, just to put it into perspective, the cost of power from a new nuclear power plant is about is at least 6 cents a kilowatt hour. The cost of uranium contributes to that is about 0.2 cents a kilowatt hour. So at a cost equivalent to 0.3 cents a kilowatt hour, the IAEA has estimated that the global resource, known resource, is enough to supply the current reactors for 100 years. At a double that cost, you have the uranium, about double that cost, according to the Japanese estimates, you have the uranium in seawater, you know, which is about 1,000 times more. As Arjun said, the geological estimates would have the, well, first of all, the IAEA's estimates, despite the fact that we're using the uranium, the IAEA's, and despite the fact that the value of $130 a kilogram, which is IAEA's cutoff for estimating uranium resources, despite the fact that inflation is eroding that value, the number keeps going up as more uranium is found. And geologists, as Arjun says, you know, believe that there's a lot more of uranium available. So I agree with him that, and also as Arjun said, reprocessing and recycling don't buy you much in terms of uranium resource savings, unless you go to breeder reactors, which have not succeeded commercially, and there's no.
Frank, are you done?
Yeah.
Sorry, you got cut off there.
Sorry.
Let me add just two things for perspective on what
sure.
Frank said. If the value of the uranium, the natural uranium in the fuel, and the cost of power is only 0.2 cents, and you have 1,000 times more resource at 0.4 or 0.5 cents, the cost of reprocessing in France, the power produced from MOX fuel use costs 2 cents more than the uranium fuel. So it's essentially doubling the operating costs, including fuel and non-fuel operating and maintenance costs of nuclear reactors, at least relative to U.S. costs. And it is tenfolding the fuel, the underlying resource costs of the uranium in the reactor. And still, the energy generation from the recovered plutonium is less than 10% of French electricity.
Just a quick follow-up on the history of all this, just to make sure that I have it right. You know, obviously, Ford and Carter shut this all down, and I believe there was an executive order to that effect. And then, if I'm remembering correctly, Reagan rescinded that executive order. What's kind of the legal status of reprocessing in the U.S. at present?
Frank?
Yes, Reagan did say that the government would be willing to license a reprocessing plant, but if it was built, but that it would have to be built with private money. And the utilities had discovered by that point that how costly reprocessing is, and decided not to pursue that. I don't know whether that's still where things stand. I suspect it is. I know that the Nuclear Regulatory Commission is currently tooling up to be able to, you know, because Areva has said that it thinks it will come forward with a proposal to build a reprocessing plant. They are tooling up to receive such an application. So my guess is that it is legal.
A couple of things. When President Reagan signed that order, he was hoping that a private company would take up and complete a reprocessing plant that had 90%, that was 90% complete when reprocessing was suspended in the U.S. An allied signal plant that had cost $400 million in those days in South Carolina. But no private party was willing to come and finish that. And secondly, if you look at the history of the French program, the French reprocessing program was conceived in connection with their breeder reactor program. And this reactor, Superphénix, that I mentioned, was to be their sort of last step in going to a breeder system. And Superphénix failed. And in 1989, they had a kind of a anguished discussion, should we stop reprocessing or not? And if you look at the quote in the report from Électricité de France from that time, it's clear that reprocessing was not a resource-oriented question or an economic-oriented question. It was an institutional-oriented question taken by two government-owned companies.
I could also add that actually France has two reprocessing plants operating in parallel. One was built for domestic purposes, and right, as Arjun says, with the expectation the breeder reactor, would require a lot of commercialization of breeder reactors would require a lot of plutonium for startup cores. The other was built with prepaid contracts from foreign companies, which were having trouble. Especially Japan and Germany, had the not in my backyard problem with spent fuel, and that second plant was paid for, and then of course the foreign utilities didn't renew their contracts for the reasons I explained before.
Our next question, operator.
The next question comes from Randy Woods of Platts. Please go ahead.
Hi, thanks guys for taking my question. I just had a quick question from Areva's virtual tour of La Hague a couple weeks ago. They talked a lot about the pricing of a reprocessing facility in the United States. They said it would probably cost about $25 billion for the reprocessing facility and for the MOX fuel fabrication facility. And they said the estimates show that the cost of reprocessing in the U.S. would be less than the $1 million fee that nuclear utility customers currently are charged for every nuclear generated kilowatt hour of electricity sold. I'm just curious, do those figures make sense to you? Are those accurate, do you think, or would you question those?
What's the size of reprocessing plant they were talking about in terms of tons per year of spent fuel processed?
It would input capacity would be 2,500 metric tons a year.
Yeah.
So a bit bigger than La Hague.
Yeah, quite a bit bigger. Areva helped the Japanese build their reprocessing plant at Rokashimura, and I believe that's about 1,000 metric tons per year. and that plant cost about $20 billion. So even if the throughput was $25 billion, 2,500 metric tons, at 20, you know, you'd get 1% of that as plutonium, 25 tons times. You'd get about 25 times 20, about 500 tons of fuel out of it. It would be very expensive fuel. It would be an order of magnitude easily more expensive than the one mil fee. Frank, do you have a back of the envelope?
Yeah, I'm just doing one here.
I was talking, so I didn't start a back of the envelope.
No, I get about 2.5 mils just from the capital cost alone. I think what's going on is the French are assuming a very low cost of capital. Dick Garwin pointed this out recently. That they're assuming like 2 or 3% rate of return on the capital investment. When you make an investment in this country, a private investment in this country, the usual rate of return you're assuming is about 10%. Some mixture of bonds and stock. And for a nuclear investment, the investors, because it's a more risky investment, investors require a still higher payback. I think what they're assuming is that it's basically free government money, and with a very low cost that's invested. So it is quite misleading compared to and of course they reprocessing would not obviate the need to have a repository, and in fact it wouldn't even reduce the size of the repository because even if you reprocessed all the spent fuel and then recycled it once, as they do in France, and you therefore had a seven times reduced tonnage, each of those tons puts out seven times the amount of heat because of all the plutonium in it, and so that would have to be spaced out correspondingly in a repository. So it would be an extra cost. It would not be an instead cost, and so the idea of using the money that is being charged for a repository for building a reprocessing plant means we wouldn't have any money for a repository.
Yeah, let me just stress that reprocessing does not get rid of the need for a deep geologic repository. Some have said, including Commissioner Magwood in his memorandum to President-elect Obama in January 2009, that we could convert everything into stable materials and we'll have transmutation techniques and so on. This is really in the idea of nuclear romance and not where we are, or not anything with any foreseeable technology. There's some physics underlying that statement, but nothing practical. We are going to need deep geologic repositories. The French have a repository program, but they don't have an operating repository. We here at IER have studied their repository program. You can actually find a 250-page report in French on their repository program on our website. The opposition to repositories in France is intense, and they generate six times as much volume that will have to be they will generate on a life cycle basis. That's a DOE estimate, to be disposed of in a repository than the United States, along with this extra heat that is produced in MOX fuel. So they haven't solved any problem. And in the meantime, they're polluting the oceans and their neighbors want them to stop. Do we want to be discharging huge amounts of liquid radioactive waste into the Gulf Stream?
Our next question, operator.
The next question comes from Keith Rogers of the Las Vegas Review-Journal. Please go ahead.
Yeah. Hi, Arjun. Hi, Frank. How you doing?
Hello, Frank. Thanks.
Here's the $64 billion question. If not yucca, then where?
Well, you know, Frank, Keith, as you know, I'm not a naysayer. We have published how a sound repository of geologic isolation program should be done. I've always felt it's been wrong to rush into site selection. That gets you both technical and political headaches. That we should do, you know, a lot of people admire the Swedish program, but very few people are willing to do what the Swedes did in the context of a nuclear moratorium, by the way. They did 25 years of research on a canister that was married to the type of geology they were investigating. They built an underground laboratory. Unlike Yucca Mountain, where the chemistry of the canister was not at all matched to the chemistry and the geology of the site, an oxidizing repository and a metal canister. After 25 years of research, they then embarked on site selection. In the United States, we've done the reverse. We've done site selection and then it had standards and then tried to back into the design of the canisters that were independent almost of the site, wound up with silver bullet canisters that would be, at least in some scenarios, quite prone to corrosion quite rapidly. So I would suggest to the Blue Ribbon Commission that they recommend researching canisters, geologic settings, and how you backfill and seal the repository. All those three things have to match, and we take 10 years to study the science before we say anything about site selection. But I do think that deep geologic repository selection can be scientifically done, but we got to remove it from this idea that Harry Reid is weak today, so we can put it in Nevada, and Harry Reid is strong today and take it out of Nevada. Yucca Mountain turned out to be a bad site, but it was all quite political.
I guess I would add that my guess is that based on the Swedish and the Finnish experience, the likely sites in the United States are already nuclear sites. Both the Swedish candidate sites and the Finnish sites are at nuclear power plants. I think there's a different perspective from communities that already have nuclear power plants about the risks of spent fuel 500 meters underground. I'm also intrigued about the idea, which is periodically surfaced and it's recently surfaced again, of deep borehole disposal. That is basically drilling holes with oil drilling rigs. Very deep, deeper than the usual oil holes, you know, maybe 5 kilometers, and putting the spent fuel down there. That could be done probably at pretty much any site. If our current political impasse continues, I think we might consider actually disposing of the spent fuel at each site, under that site. When you look actually at the Swedish and the Finnish repositories, per ton of spent fuel, they don't cost any more than the much bigger repository that was designed for Yucca Mountain. And so, if in fact this deep borehole approach panned out, then you would really not have any significant economies of scale. You'd just be drilling holes. So for me, Plan Z is for each power plant. And some, by the way, some of our power plant stations have, some of our states have more spent fuel in them than Sweden or Finland. So I mean, the having multiple smaller repositories may be the way we end up going.
Yeah, it might not do a lot for the support for nuclear power. You know, I think we need, you know, in my opinion, there's no really good solution to this thing, and we should think of going to renewable energy. But that will not solve the massive problem we have, and that's in the pipeline. I really think we need to go back to the basics. I mean, if you look at the 1983, and we can start by looking at the 1983 National Academy report that was commissioned by the DOE, and nobody in charge ever seems to have taken it seriously. And they recommended a process for thinking through how this is to be done, what are the criteria, what are the standards. They evaluated various types of sites. Yucca Mountain didn't come out very well, by the way, in that evaluation. And we need to put this geologic isolation program on a sound scientific footing. In a democracy, you know, all decisions are political, especially big ones, and they should be. But making politically convenient short-term decisions is not the way to handle a multi-generational problem.
Follow-up question, Arjun. You had said there were three things: research into the canisters, geologic setting, and what was the third thing?
The third one, you know, when you have a repository, this doesn't come up as much with the deep boreholes question. I haven't researched that particular issue that much. It does come up. But when you build a mine, basically, you're making a huge hole in the ground, and you no longer have your original geologic setting. So people have said that in Africa there was the Oklo reactor, and the fission products haven't gone very far, and so we can isolate waste. But in this case, you're actually making a huge mine, and then you have to backfill it. You're creating new joints. You're putting very, very hot, thermally hot waste in there, so you're changing the temperature conditions drastically in the repository. And so you have to marry the backfill, how it gets resaturated, and the materials you use, both with the canisters and the geologic setting, and make sure you haven't developed new pathways for the waste to leak out. And so you have to, and I've developed a new appreciation for how difficult this particular problem is ever since we looked into the program in France and worked with a couple of experts who specialize in these areas. So these three things need to be done simultaneously: the seal and the backfill of the repository, the canister, and the setting.
Our next question, operator.
The next question comes from Wayne Barber of Power Daily. Please go ahead.
Hi, thank you both very much for taking my question. I veering slightly in a different direction, I was going to ask both of you to look at your crystal ball and predict what type of key recommendations the Blue Ribbon Commission might actually come up with. It seemed like during their opening ceremonies that they wanted to leave the door ajar for the possibility of at least taking a serious look at reprocessing. What do you guys see coming of this process in this report?
Frank, your crystal ball is better than mine.
it's moderately cloudy. But my understanding of the charge is that they are to look at interim storage, and centralized interim storage, as well as on-site interim storage. And in fact, I think that for spent fuel at on sites where the reactor has been shut down, there are on the order of 10 of those. About 3,000 tons of fuel out of the about 70,000 tons of fuel is what I call orphan spent fuel. I mean, that could be consolidated. Then they are to look at reprocessing, variants of reprocessing. And they're not to look at specific sites, it's my understanding, but they could certainly address the what Arjun was talking about, the siting process, what would be an objective siting process, and one that the public could trust. And I think they could learn a lot in that area from what has been done in Finland and Sweden in terms of consultation with the local jurisdictions and the publics. I certainly don't have a prediction of where they'll come out. I think it's they're starting out with a lot of people who don't know much about the subject. And then mixed in with people who have strong opinions on the subject, and how that mix will work out, I don't think anybody can predict.
Yeah, now that my crystal ball has been cleared up a little bit by Frank, I can say something. I think the pressures to say something positive about reprocessing are going to be very strong. And one of the reasons I directed the recommendations of this report to the Blue Ribbon Commission, which I am going to send to the Commission and also to Secretary Chu, is that they should really rule out reprocessing. We've got to make interim on-site storage more secure. It's very, very important that we do that. There's going to be dry storage. Now, whether it's consolidated because there are contracts with utilities or whether it's on-site, there'll probably be some mixture of the two. That should be the most important venue of where they should focus in terms of the short and medium term. And as I've suggested, the process for actually how we're going to develop a sound deep geologic repository program. I also hope, and this is, there are several recommendations in my report along these lines, that the Commission will do some work to separate fact from fiction and science from mythology about, this romance with the French. I mean, I understand romance with the French. I'm married to a French woman, but this particular romance with the French is not connected with the facts. I hope that the Commission will devote a significant amount of time and resources to put the U.S. discussion on a sound scientific footing. Otherwise, we'll be back to square one, or worse, and we'll be headed off in a direction that's not going to solve any of our problems.
Is there a follow-up question? If not, we'll proceed to what I believe will be, based on our available time, our final question. I believe it's a follow-up, operator.
Yes, that follow-up comes from David Biello of the Scientific American. Please go ahead.
Hi, thanks. And I'm sorry to be the last question. But it's, you speculated on wishing, I can't remember who you wanted to ask them, but it might have been the Blue Ribbon Commission, to ask the French exactly how much more they're getting out of the uranium thanks to reprocessing. What are your thoughts? If we're using 1% in the once through, how is the MOX fuel performing, and what percentage are they getting from the underlying resource, as far as you can tell?
Yeah, the calculations are in my report. I mean, if you start on the basis of the fresh fuel that's fed into the reactor, about 4.5% of it is fissioned in the first round. And what the French are doing, re-enriching about a third of the recovered uranium and using most of the plutonium as MOX fuel to generate electricity, they're pushing that 4.5% to 5.5%. So, but based on the underlying natural uranium resource,
mm-hmm.
they're using about 0.7%, which is just marginally more than in a once through system, because almost all of the uranium in a light water system winds up as depleted uranium.
Actually, Arjun, I think you're a little high. I think the typically about 0.4% of the 0.7% U-235 in natural uranium ends up in low enriched uranium. So you start with that 0.4%, and then you and that's about what is fission, the equivalent to
yes,
what's fission.
Right.
And then if you add about, I think with recycling with MOX would bring you up to about 0.45%.
Yeah, I did sort of some theoretical extreme calculations.
Yeah, no, I think you assume 0.2% and tails and so on.
Yeah, right.
And so I mean we're within range of each other, but I just I'm not contradicting you. I'm just saying.
No, that's fine.
I'm just saying you're being generous to the French.
I'm being generous to the French. Well, I always like to be generous to the
French. Okay, thank you very much. Oh, and how has the MOX fuel performed, generally speaking?
I haven't looked into the performance of MOX fuel. They did have to modify their reactors. They cannot use it in 30 of their 58 reactors, and they're using it in 20, just one of their reactors, a 900 megawatt addition. But I've not actually looked into the MOX fuel performance.
I know a little bit. I think the one problem has been that they haven't been able to make it last as long as low enriched uranium fuel. And so that's led to some complications in the refueling schedule, that it isn't fully equivalent to the low-enriched uranium fuel. Also, the U.S. is trying to get rid of some of its excess weapons plutonium as MOX. And since we don't have a MOX fuel fabrication facility up yet, sent some of our plutonium over to be fabricated into MOX fuel assemblies for then testing in a couple of reactors here. And they were supposed to go around for three refueling cycles. I think the refueling cycles are about 18 months with, you replace a third of the fuel. And they had to pull it out after two refueling cycles because fuel expanded so much. Again, we found that it was not equivalent to as good as the low enriched uranium fuel from that point of view. You couldn't get the full theoretical amount of energy out of it.
And I believe that is, given our available time, is going to be our final question and final set of responses. You've been listening to a news event sponsored by the Institute for Energy and Environmental Research. A streaming audio replay of this news event will be available later on this afternoon on the website for IEER, which is also where you can find the report that has been released today, as well as a related news release. And again, that's the Institute for Energy and Environmental Research at www.ieer.org. Questions after this news event can be addressed to Elise Aaron Wolf at 703-276-3265. Again, that's Elise Aaron Wolf at 703-276-3265. Elise can make sure that you reach either one of our two experts on the call today, as well as get the material if you're having any difficulty acquiring it from the website for the Institute for Energy and Environmental Research. On behalf of the two speakers that you've heard from today, IEER President Dr. Arjun Makhijani and Frank von Hippel, co-chair of the International Panel on Fissile Materials and President of Public and International Affairs at the Woodrow Wilson School at Princeton University, as well as everyone else associated with IEER, we'd like to thank you for joining us today. That concludes this news event.